I want to welcome my next three guests on the Gamers Confab special holiday edition. And we're going to wrap it up with these three. Originally, it was going to be four. Duncan Fife, author of the hit Self-Destruct blog, we invited him. He came. We were here. We were all ready. And we just weren't able to get a good connection. Duncan lives in New Zealand, so, and we're, you know, kind of juggling a lot of balls here with the conference calls. So I'm sorry we weren't able to get Duncan, but I promise I'm going to get him on the podcast sometime soon. I guess most people know, because I mentioned a lot, that I really love his writing and his work. And so never fear, we'll get Duncan on. But for now, today, we've got three guests that I'm delighted to have with me. One is Wes Ertelak, who is also known as Iroquois Plissken on his blog, Versus Cuckooland. Also joined by Tom Kim from the Gamma Sutra Radio, GDC Radio, Fat Pixels Radio.
GDC Radio, Gamma Sutra Podcast.
And also a guest who's been with me before and who's sort of like Mr. Podcast now. The Idle Thumbs guys get him and, you know, he's becoming a podcast celebrity quickly. And that would be Mr. Steve Gaynor from 2K Marin.
Hi.
Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
Welcome, Tom, and welcome, Wes.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So I asked each of you to list your favorite game of 2008 and send them to me, and you were kind enough to do that. And three very different games will be mentioned here today. Why don't we launch it with you, Wes? Get us going on your favorite game of 2008.
Sure. Well, my favorite game this year was Grand Theft Auto 4. And so maybe it would be best to just start out by talking about the fact that the game has some problems, right? Like people who, you know, I feel like Rockstar, they set out, they have this really good sort of murderous mayhem style of gameplay that they've done for a long time. And what they've tried to do with Grand Theft Auto 4 is really meld it with a new serious approach to the storytelling. And I think a lot of people play the game and they just notice that, like, these two tendencies and these two aspirations really pulled the game in different directions. And, you know, there's a way that the game kind of loses its momentum in the second act, and the third act is really bad and all that stuff. So let's just get that out of the way. And for me, the reason it's my favorite game is really, it's two things. First of all, like, the impact of that world that it had on you when you first started up that game, and the impact of the setting and the way the city just kind of washed over you when you started that game is really the thing that's most memorable to me about playing games this year. The way that, you know, it was really something that I felt that had been done to a certain degree, but the way they stepped it up and the sort of quantum leap that they took over what they had done in all the previous games in terms of, you know, just the detail of the city, you know, like each block looks different. The people in each block, you go two blocks anyway, the people look different. The world looks different. The buildings look different. You know, that experience of sort of just going around the city was something that I feel like had never really been done in a game for me before in that way. And so just that sort of like blunt force impact of the way the world just washed over you and had that wow factor. I think everyone when that came out, that was something that really everyone noticed. And then it kind of faded over time. People, you know, played through the game. The narrative got kind of, you know, the gameplay got stale over a period of time. People just really forgot about what a really unique experience and what a new kind of way of presenting a world that game gave you. So,
yeah, you know, let me ask, like, I'm going to try and be chatty. when you compare the impact of first playing GTA 4 with when you originally played like GTA 3, I assume you played it probably when it came out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, how would you compare those two experiences? That have like the same degree or a different kind of impact on you as GTA 3 did, or what?
Yeah, well, I mean, I kind of feel like it's almost just the accumulation of detail that they got in terms of really creating the kind of details that bring a world to life. You know, the way the billboards are positioned on the buildings, the way that the architecture varies, and, you know, you drive two blocks anyway, you know, the architecture varies, the way that the people talk to you, all that kind of stuff. Like, it wasn't necessarily like a huge change in terms of the sort of form of the game and the way that the streets are laid out or anything like that. It's just, they nailed all the little details, you know, like, all these things. Like, I think of, you know, the first time you stopped short at a crosswalk and there was a guy walking across the street, and like they, you know, the cup of coffee spills in their hand, you know, kind of like little tiny details, you know, driving, you know, at the bottom of the island of Liberty City, you know, in Battery Park during the lunch hour, and there's all the people talking on their cell phones and sitting there and eating lunch during the lunch hour. Like those like little things. It was just over the course, all those little details really work together to sort of create this world that, you know, even towards the end of the game, you know, I remember the last subway ride I had to take to go from, you know, the far island to the other one. And, you know, there are all those times where you can just hop in the taxis and hit the warp button in order to kind of get across the world real quick. And even towards the end, it still had that sort of pull where I wanted to jump in a subway just so I could sit there and like watch the world go by, you know. And that's something, no game has ever really impacted me that way, where I really just wanted to see it in that way. So
what did you spend most of your time in that game doing? I mean, were you the kind of player who just kind of wandered around taking in the scenery between missions for long stretches?
Well, I mean, it was partially that, you know, you kind of got used to the idea where I knew to a certain extent, like, those two aspects pulled against each other, right? Like the missions are always kind of like pulling you into doing a certain set of tasks when, you know, and it isn't the sort of world like, you know, Fallout 3 that you could just wander at your leisure and find things to do and see. I mean, I felt I spent a certain amount of time just kind of going around and taking it in before I kind of got tired of it and kind of went back into, you know, trying to go through the missions. But it just had such a memorable impact on me. It was really different. Even when I played other games that tried to do the same sort of thing, like Far Cry 2 and Fallout 3, which are both games I think really did, you know, a comparable job of really creating this memorable, really detailed, really granularly detailed world, you know, that in its own way, it still stood out to me. Something just about the way it had done and the way they had gotten all those details and all the really variety of the, you know, in that one city. So
do you think that it partially came out of the presence of more just kind of neutral civilians walking around? Because that's a big difference from either of the two games, is that there's just a civilian populace that's kind of doing its own thing, which the Wasteland or the Africa setting in Far Cry 2 don't have.
Yeah, it's partially that. It's part that it's much more dense than either of those games, you know. In either of those games, you can, you know, in Fallout or in Far Cry, you can really kind of, you know, the scenery has a kind of expansiveness to it where you can just kind of wander around, where, you know, it's really the density. It's the way that there's so much variety in terms of what things look like. You know, there's parks, there's all these landmarks, there's all these really indelible sort of New York style landmarks that really show up there in a way that's memorable. I mean, I just remember, you know, the first time you get to that island of Algonquin, you know, when you cross the bridge, and you know, the first time you're really in there and you think I can drive through the island of Manhattan. And it was something that really, in a certain way, approximated what it felt like to, you know, drive through the middle of the city in a car. It was incredible. So
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just wondering if, to myself, actually, if the setting actually made that game more difficult than something like Fallout 3 or Far Cry 2. Because it is a real-world setting as opposed to a post-apocalyptic wasteland and this kind of over-the-top African, warlord.
Yeah. That's an interesting point because, you know, for me, these F games, you're exploring to find things out and you're discovering things as they sort of present themselves to you, as opposed to a guy like me who used to live in Manhattan. I mean, I want to explore that city and find the stuff I know. You know, I mean, that was part of the charge for me, was just opening up the island, getting off so I could go travel around and just sort of match up my memories of the city geographically. And that I got a lot of fun just out of that, which is a totally different reason, a totally different kind of exploring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you would drive through parts of the city in order to find things, like trying to find the, you know, you would try to find the Met, you would try to find, you know, you would try to drive through certain parts of Central Park just to see what they looked like, just to see what they had done, you know. I remember that, you know, you remember the first time for me, I remember driving the first time you drove through Times Square and you just like sat there in the middle of Times Square, you know, rotating the camera around, you know, like a, you know, like a giddy tourist. I mean, there's no other really game I can think of that kind of created that experience for you, just wanting to be there. So
can I ask you just one more question?
Sure.
To what degree did the protagonist of the game, this Nico, your relationship with him, or your feeling about him, or if any, I mean, to what degree does this backstory, immigrant story, all that stuff play into your connection with the game?
Well, that was the main other thing I wanted to talk about, is that, you know, I'm I'm not someone who really approaches games in terms of relating the characters. I'm really not, you know, if I'm looking to find memorable characters that are well drawn, you know, in entertainment, I often, you know, I'll read a book or I'll watch a movie or watch a, you know, a well done TV show. That's usually not something I really prize in games. And one of the, I mean, something about the way the protagonist and the story unfolded really kind of got its hooks into me in a way that really hasn't happened to me before, I don't think. And I don't know if it's a combination of, I think the scripting is really good, the acting is really well, the cutscenes, the way they're directed and the way they handled the body language and using that expressively was really, really good. And, you know, as much as the style of the gameplay contrasted with the way that they're trying to do the character, I found myself over time really wrapped up in thinking about trying to, you know, when the game gave me choices to make, I found myself when I was trying to, you know, figure out what I want to do, trying to think myself into the protagonist and think myself into the way that he had been portrayed in the cutscenes and act accordingly. You know, it was so, to a certain extent, it was so convincing that I was willing to do boring things in service of the characters, right? Mm-hmm. Like all that, the sort of character development stuff, you know, the dating of the girls and the going out with the friends, like that stuff is boring, you know? Like yeah. when little Jacob like calls you to drive him to the airport, I'm like, this game is having me do an errand for yeah. it, you know? But it was like, for, you know, I ended up doing those things, not only because I, you know, I kind of felt like, it was very odd. I got to the point where I was like, well, it was something that Nico would do. You know, he would drive to the airport. And it was worth it to me for those like little snippets of conversation, the way that, you know, they wrote the dialogue during the little parts when you'd be driving in the car. And the way that the characters talk to each other just really felt to me the way that an actual person, you know, they just sit there and, you know, they would kind of like shoot the breeze about what had been going on in their life. And it was same with, you know, Nico's relationship to that character, Kate. I mean, I think people really were sort of turned off by the fact that Kate was a sort of gameplay non sequitur, right? But the way they developed that relationship, you know, if you invested time in it and you did boring things to make that relationship happen, I really felt like it rewarded you on a narrative level and really no other way.
I think that was one of the things that the game actually kind of had. It had some trouble supporting fully, because I know a lot of people that really wanted to sort of roleplay Nico, as you say. But the game, it's trying to let you be the crazy guy that kills everybody sort of be nice Nico. And so my anecdote about that is when I very first started playing the game, it gets through the opening cutscene and you drop off Roman and you go to your apartment and you go to sleep and get up the next day or whatever. And, your next goal is to go meet Roman at his cab shop, you know, and you're like, I don't know, I six blocks away or something. And so I was like, well, Nico seems nice. He would hail a cab to get over there, but I didn't know which button did it. And so I was just hoping that like the carjack button, if you went up to the back, make you get in the back of it, you know, kind of thing. And so I tried it and I'm like, okay, I'm going to be the nice guy. I'm just going to hail a cab over there, pay $5. And I press the Y button. It just goes, I'm robbing you. Don't make me kill you. And I'm like, well, I guess that's who I am now. Yeah. Game over. I can't be nice Nico anymore.
I mean, it
which
really
is sort of disappointing, but it's a tough problem to solve, you know?
Yeah, it was really jarring the way that, you know, you try to think your way into being a decent human being, and then you're like, oh, I got to carjack people just in order to get anywhere, you know?
Yeah.
And why, you know, it made you think, like, why am I killing all these people? You know, it was very jarring. But I mean, I don't know. The very fact that the game made you think about that conflict, I think, was a sort of testament to the way that the way the character was drawn and the direction of the cutscenes and the dialogue was really kind of effective. So
I think they made some interesting choices in storytelling in that game, in that in the last act of the story, you really find out that Nico is kind of a sociopath. And that, to me, I don't know, it's like people do try to roleplay that character, and I think they were trying to pull off something pretty clever in that story. They just figured the people who play that way would end up being sociopaths anyway, and the people who were invested in the story would find out in the end that it really didn't matter what the character's choices were. But, you know, I know it kind of fell flat to me in that. Yeah. It's a very ambitious game, but I think from a storytelling perspective, I was quite disappointed when I found out that aspect of Nico's character.
Yeah, I mean, I had trouble with the ongoing justification where, you know, he seemed like a decent guy who, I, you know, sort of the only thing he knew how to do to get by was to do jobs for these underworld types. But like every time you would take a mission, they'd be like, we want you to kill 20 people and take their money, give it to us. And Nico's like, I just want to get paid. I need money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but the thing is, in the game, I had like $500,000 goddamn dollars. I didn't need any money. What was I spending my money on? Like I had an apartment that was for free. Nico did not actually need the money, according to the game. And yet that was the only reason that he went out and killed like scores and scores of people.
This is kind of a bizarre reading, but I took Nico's sort of restless, mindless, self-destructive drive for accumulation as a part of the game's sort of overall satire of capitalism. Uh-huh. And the intent of the game, I think on a story level, was to present this as a story about, you know, the American dream gone horribly wrong, right? You know, to the extent that, you know, at the very end of the game, did you guys all finish the game or?
I completed it.
Yeah.
I did not.
Most people do not. I mean, I think most people kind of ran up against the fact that, you know, it gets tired after a while. But at the end of the game, you get an achievement that says you win an exclamation point. And I almost felt that it was meant to be ironic that, you know,
yeah,
by the end of the game,
sure.
Yeah, that all the things that you had accomplished really didn't mean anything to you anymore. You know, if you have chosen to invest, time by dating Kate, she gets killed during the third act and there's nothing left for you anymore.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it is an interesting tension. I thought that I'm not sure if it's intentional or not, but within the sort of the larger context of this sort of over the top satire of American consumerism and consumption, I thought that the fact that Nico ends up as this, you know, corrupt sociopath who's just killing people because other people tell him to do and doesn't really have any choice in the matter was I think kind of intentional. I don't know.
Well, you sort of made me want to pick up that game again, to be honest with you, Wes. I mean, I don't know whether I'll pick it up for a long time, but I didn't actually get nearly as far into the game as I thought I would. I mean, I put that game down, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours maybe I put into it. I dropped it like a hot potato.
Yeah.
And maybe I should give it another look.
Yeah.
I mean, if nothing else, you should jump into it and mess around with the civilians and play with their euphoria physics, make them stumble over things, bump them with your car until they just kind of fall on their butts and then get back up. That's one of the best parts of the game for me. Yeah.
For a game that I like that much, I had the same experience where I kind of burned out on it after a couple hours, and I was glad that I came back to it because when I came back to it, the world kind of knocked me over all over again. Mm-hmm. So,
all right. Well, thank you, Wes. I'm going to toss it over to Tom now. And Tom, what's your favorite game of 2008?
Well, I'll have to caveat this by saying it's I have an interesting choice because it's not really 100% my choice. It was really more informed by my son. He's 3.5 and he is obsessed with Castle Crashers. He just loves it. I mean, we can't get him to wear certain outfits unless we tell him it's related to Castle Crashers in some way. And he has, you know, I've already resigned myself to the fact the kid is probably doomed to be a complete geek, just like his dad. We have a basketball hoop that we can hang up on a door and he can throw little baskets on it. And it, from day one, it was never a basketball hoop. He disassembled it and turned it into a mega axe from Castle Crashers. I don't know where the term mega axe came from. I never said that to him. He just kind of picked it up on his own. So that and his little snow cap is his Castle Crashers helmet. He's just obsessed with this game. And, you know, same, I guess caveats that Wes put in about his game. I know the game it's really old school. It has a few little nice, you know, highlights or earmarks for more modern gameplay, but for the most part, it's a 2D side scrolling beat 'em up. And, you know, and I don't know, I guess I popped it in one day and we were playing it together. And I think that's another reason why, I like playing the game with him is because he actually can play the game. I mean, we can put it on 2-player mode and he can sit there. Of course, sometimes he'll trap himself on the edge and I'll have to kind of goose him along with, you know, moving his thumbstick over so I can, you know, make a little bit further in the level. But, you know, it's essentially a game that doesn't have any like real lives don't really count. You can always jump back in at any time and it's very forgiving that way. And he just, I don't know, I think he actually gets some of the little touches of humor that the Behemoth threw in there. And, you know, he just, it's just for me anyway, that I listed that as one of my possible games of the year, just mostly because of him. And there's a couple other reasons as well. This year in particular has been a difficult one for my family. I started out the year with a pretty bad health crisis. And then since then, I think, well, for my day job, for my mortgage paying job, I work as a contractor in advertising. And I think the big ad agency networks could see the economic slowdown coming a little early. Traditionally, summer is a slow time anyway for us, though I've never had this problem before in my work. But summer was very slow, and then fall was terrible. And so we were really, you know, I've had to really think hard about which games I wanted to buy. I couldn't just go out and buy everything. And for me, you know, the downloadable space and these kind of small, less expensive games have really been my, you know, I guess what saved me in the game playing holiday, because I can pick up these things and, you know, and they're not that expensive. So I can, you know, justify putting down $15 or whatever it costs for Castle Crashers to, you know, to buy something, to buy this little entertainment for myself. And it's also forced me to kind of, you know, I guess when you have a dearth of riches, you kind of have a tendency to not complete things that you do. And because I'm buying less games, I'm actually having to spend more time with them as well. And, you know, for me, just, I don't know, Castle Crashers just kind of stuck out because I was kind of compelled to finish it because I'm playing with my son.
Yeah.
And he kind of wanted to, you know, see how it all turned out. So, you know, I put in a lot of time with that game. And I'm also going back and playing stuff in my pile of shame as well, stuff that I don't really play that much.
Well, you can also go back and, you know, like one of the things I really liked about the game was that there were like 40 weapons and, you know, all the little animal orbs and stuff like that. There were just enough like little touches to like keep you coming back. And
sure, I have the animal handler achievement.
Oh, really? You got all of them?
Got them all.
Wow. That is devotion.
Yeah, like I said, it's like, you know, when you're forced to make specific choices about the games you play, you know, you do tend to spend more time with them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds more like how probably all of us played games when we were kids, you know, when you couldn't just go out and buy all of them. So instead, you played through. Well, I mean, when I was a kid, I was a big fan of Double Dragon, which is a side-scrolling beat 'em up, and I know damn well I played through that thing. I don't know how many times. Yeah, and really, and River City Ransom as well, which is even probably closer to what Castle Crashers is. Yeah. And yeah, you just sort of inhabit them inside and out, and really get every single little drop of entertainment out of them.
It's interesting because other people have written about this recently. It seems because of the economic crisis we're in, that we just routinely assume that everybody can just keep up with all these games we keep talking about. And I think a smaller and smaller audience is really able to do that. I am more than ever on my blog. I hear people saying or posting comments like, I wish I could play that game. I can't. I wish I could buy that console, but I can't. You know, this is, we don't live in reality. I think those of us who play just a one big game after another because we can, or because we're able to get our hands on these games. That's just not how it is for most people.
Yeah. Multi-title. Platform exclusives, especially, I think, people have a hard time justifying, you know, buying a whole new box just to play a single game. It's gotta be a real backbreaker for, I mean, I already had all the consoles already, luckily, because last year was better than this year. But, you know, just still, I really, really find myself in a situation where I not only sympathize, but empathize with people who can't afford everything off the list.
Yeah. Another thing I wonder about, too, is if I think about the year that I had playing games, this was the year I played probably 10 times more co-op than any year I could think of. I mean, suddenly this was the year of playing co-op games. Did anyone else find themselves in that sort of mode more often this year?
Oh yeah, most definitely. And one of the things actually, you know, about Castle Crashers is it was the kind of game that anyone could play. Like, I got my girlfriend and my roommates, girls who don't play games, like they were better at that game than I was within, you know, a very short period of time. And that was something I really loved about that, but, you know, but also everything co-op, like Left 4 Dead, you know, things like that, I think, were the most memorable games from this year. Not necessarily just all the single player games, but so much good co-op games this year.
Yeah, I played more co-op games than usual, partly because another designer and I at work have tended to play co-op stuff like on lunches and whatnot. We've dug into some back catalog stuff. It's good. It's an entirely different kind of you know, what value that you get out of a co-op game than a single player game.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It seems to me too, in some ways, that the like Guitar Hero and Rock Band games sort of reminded us of that in a funny way. I mean,
yeah,
there's just the fun you get out of playing those co-op is so much greater than if you're just playing by yourself or even online with somebody.
I find it interesting how they're designing those games differently with an eye toward how people are playing them. It really is more of a case now where they're a lot more like karaoke games now, where, you know, they're incorporating no fail modes and,
yeah,
you know, it really is about the joy of playing with a group of people than it is about playing a game, you know, a thing that has, you know, hard set goals in place. And
yeah, I think you can definitely see the growing pains of kind of coming to grips with fully supporting that that kind of mode of play between Rock Band 1 and Rock Band 2, where that was almost the majority of changes in Rock Band 2 were stuff to make it way easier just to pick up with any group of people and play some songs together, you know, without all of this fiddling with your profiles and, yeah, somebody's not good at it, so you fail out, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, is it even a game? I mean, does Harmonix even think of it as a game? I mean, it's a music toy in a certain way.
Yeah, I think for sure they must support it as a game because it has some really well thought out rules. But that might apply the most to either people who are playing it single player or with sort of a devoted band who want to go for, you know, 5-star high score leaderboard kind of stuff. Right. I think the opposite side of it is that they're taking that sort of very tight system and loosening up the requirements, you know, to make it more fun and kind of loose for people that don't really care about the, you know, trying to maximize their inputs into the game system.
Yeah. Why don't we toss the ball to you, Steve, and you can tell us about your favorite, and we'll see if we can throw Duncan some love here too, and make sure we mention his favorite because we know what his favorite is.
Right, his favorite it would also be my favorite, but I'm going to disqualify it because I can't conscientiously call Fallout 3 my favorite game of the year because it's my favorite game of all time.
Wow, coming out with that pronouncement out of the gate.
Wow. Goaty would be kind of faint praise for, like, you know, what? Do you call Citizen Kane the best movie in 1941? No. so yeah, I mean there are things that that I loved about it, and the thing is that there are a lot of the same things in a different context that I love about the game that I will call my game of the year, which is Yakuza 2, Sega production. Have you guys? I know that Michael played at least some of it. Have you guys played it at all?
Just a little bit. I mean, it was one of those games. Well, another thing I've had to resort to with my new gaming budget is I went to rental, so a lot of stuff I get is GameFly. And because of, you know, I only have the one game out at a time deal. So I'm kind of under constant pressure to return things quickly if I want to get to the next thing on my queue. So I spent a little bit of time with it, but regrettably not as much as I would have liked to.
Yeah, I bought it, but I haven't started it yet. But My Xbox died 2 days ago, so I think it may have moved to the top of the pile.
Yeah, I did finally finish it, and I should say I would probably never have even started it, quite honestly, if Steve hadn't written about it. Steve was pretty crazy about that game and was pretty effusive about it early on, so I picked it up purely for that reason.
I was Twittering pretty hard about it for a little while. and the stuff that I was Twittering about were the weird little player stories that came out. Well, they were, you know, sort of authored stories that I discovered and drew out and found a lot of joy from sharing. So the baseline about what Yakuza 2 is, it's, for one, it's the sequel to the first game, Yakuza, but the premise is that you are a guy who is a high-ranking Japanese mafia boss, kind of with a heart of gold, sort of a samurai code, honor, not gonna hurt innocents kind of dude. In the first game, you went through this whole saga and you left the Yakuza behind, and then in 2, they pull you back in, right? And so basically, it's an action RPG that is based in large part on kind of the structure of Shenmue, but with being more of a pure beat 'em up and kind of linear guided story experience in modern Tokyo and Osaka. But the stuff that I found the most interesting about the game was totally outside of the main spine of the story, which is sort of a, you know, cinematic, heavily authored, like melodramatic tale about corrupt cops and trying to find out who betrayed who and everything. But in between the main story beats of the game, you can just wander around whichever city the chapter that you're playing happens to be in, whether it's Tokyo or Osaka. And in between those narrative anchors, which tend to take themselves kind of very seriously, the world is just sort of weird and wacky. Like it's a really strange sort of semi-surreal view of what being in modern day Japan is all about, because you're just wandering around town kind of maybe killing time until the next story section is going to come up or whatever, and you'll just run into strange people that have requests for you. Like a guy wants you to win a prize from him out of an arcade machine so he can give it to his girlfriend. And it's just something that, you know, a guy flags you down and now you have to play this arcade game in an arcade and win a stuffed animal for 5 minutes. And then you go back to being a hardcore Yakuza guy that's going to beat up hundreds of people. And all of these little sort of character nodes are floating around the world, and they sometimes come back to pay you back later. Like, for instance, when you're walking around the city, there are these barkers that are outside of the different establishments like bars and stuff, who will kind of force you to take tissues that they have that have like ads on them. This is something that happens in Tokyo, and so you end up with these things in your pockets that are generally kind of useless. But at some point you find this busker out on the street who's like playing guitar and singing, but when you come up to him, he says like, "Oh, my nose is so stuffed up, I can't sing, I can't make any money. Oh, I could really use a tissue." And so you give him this tissue and he thanks you, and later on, if you have if you get into a fight near him, like some gangster guys hassle you or whatever, before the fight starts, this busker guy takes his acoustic guitar and throws it to you, and it's like a QTE to catch it, and then you just like smash it over your enemy's head and get an instant knockout on him. And there's like stuff where you meet, where there's you like the sort of a sort of female ghost who's sort of like the Ring, kind of is peeking around a corner. There's a little subplot about that. There's some guy that wants you to listen to his amateur rap and tell him whether it's good or not. Just like, so you do all this weird stuff that's sort of like, what the hell goes on in Tokyo? This place is crazy.
Did you see the guys in diapers, Steve?
What was it?
The guys in diapers.
Yes, that was incredible. Oh, that's so good. Yeah. There's subplots like that all over the place, where you meet somebody who's just like, oh, it seems like some Yakuza guys are hassling me, and then you end up getting dragged into like this fetish bar where they're all wearing diapers and being babied by like women that are wearing like nanny outfits and stuff, and they're like, they invite you to come join them, and you're like, no, that's not my scene or whatever. And then they get up and all start fighting you, and so you beat up like five guys in diapers, and you're like hitting them with like toy rocking horses and stuff, and just comes out of nowhere. It's like, this is what happens when you're walking down the street in Tokyo. And so that was the stuff that I loved about it, was just walking around this place and kind of, as Wes was saying about GTA, feeling a very intent, like convinced or evocatively rendered version of this city, and like, oh, I'm in a foreign place, I'm surrounded by the sounds of the city and all of the, you know, Japanese text on the signs, and you go into shops and they're weird, you know, like different kinds of bottled drinks you can buy and all this stuff that definitely makes you feel like you're in a foreign land, and yeah, you can just wander at will and really feel immersed in somewhere that you're not used to. And also there are just these amazingly odd threads that you can pull on, you know, to pull more characterization out of the space and have these little self-contained experiences that are really easy to relate to people, because they sort of are generally like, I met this guy, something weird happened, and then I went back to the city. Isn't that crazy? And, you know, it's the kind of structure to an experience of kind of being there and finding neat stuff in it and then getting to kind of have had that experience and go back to what you're doing that I really love. And having been to Tokyo and Osaka before, it's sort of like your guys' experience with the Liberty City in GTA. It's an interesting thing to see a virtual representation of somewhere you've been and just be like, I remember that, kind of. So, just a lovely, wonderful little game and lo-fi. And I love that, probably just to save money, they didn't do an English voice track for Yakuza 2 on like Yakuza 1. it's all the original Japanese text, which, and I mean Japanese voice acting, which again just helps reinforce the idea that you are a character that is in Japan and experiencing the feeling of being there. It's just a cool little kind of unassuming wacky game.
Yeah,
a lot.
You know, it's interesting to me because Steve, you're a developer. You work for 2K Marin, mm-hmm. and it would seem to me that you know, I don't know how Yakuza did in Japan. I know stateside, you know, the numbers weren't that great, but you know, typically when a game doesn't do super well, they don't really, you know, worldwide nowadays, it seems like every game market's a global game market. They don't really put a lot of money into the sequel. But for them to take this game and spend that much time and attention on these incidentals is really quite surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is, I mean, these were some of the highest budgeted PS2 games ever. And I believe they're actually quite popular, or they sold really well in Japan. And I think that the whole, like, supporting side experiences and sort of wandering off of the critical path and everything comes out of its Shenmue roots of being an action RPG at its base, because you have an inventory and you have stats and you level up and everything. But yeah, the first game didn't do so great in the States, and they didn't localize Yakuza 2 for like 2 years after it had been released, I think. But then they were releasing a couple of sequels for it for the PS3, which I think Sega decided, okay, we're going to bring Yakuza 3 on the PS3 over to the States. So we're going to have to, we feel obligated kind of to localize Yakuza 2 so we can have the whole trilogy available. And I'm thankful for it because it's a unique, unique game for sure.
Yeah. It just seems like stateside, you know, well, you know how it is. They're not going to give any time or budget to any part of the game that isn't, you know, useful in some way. So, but, you know, yeah, I guess it's to everyone's benefit that they did it that. But I hear interesting stories that Yakuza 3 is actually going to be set in a medieval setting, not in a modern day setting.
The actual progression of the series is there's Yakuza 1 and 2, and then there's the one you're thinking of, which is like a feudal times one, is sort of a spinoff. It's like, okay, Yakuza and then a subtitle. And Yakuza 3 proper is actually already or is soon to be released in Japan, and it's another modern day one starring the same characters and everything.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, the other thing too is that they hire very, very fine actors. I mean, the voice acting, and by the way, I don't pretend to understand Japanese. I can't translate or anything, but I am a pretty serious fan of Japanese cinema, and you know, you can understand fine voice acting when you hear it, I would argue.
Yeah,
and sure. This guy Tetsuya Watari, who appears as sort of the leading role in these Yakuza games, he's a very, very fine actor, and I think the game delivers, you know, the cinematic sort of aspects of it, what it tries to do, very well. I think it's very well animated, and I think in some of the things that you were saying, Wes, about what you liked about GTA in that regard, I think this game does well too. It is a little melodramatic, I think. You're right, Steve, but we rarely see the caliber of actors that they're using in this game one after another. Rarely see that kind of caliber of actor in English video games.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that there's some amount of sort of a voice act, a more respected voice acting culture in Japan generally, where actual good actors sort of throw themselves into doing voice roles, and it definitely shows. That was something that why I was disappointed with them kind of steamrolling the Japanese track in the first game, was that they released the demo of Yakuza 1 in the States with the Japanese voices, and it was so good. And it really made me feel like, oh man, these are, you know, Yakuza characters, Japanese characters in the place they are. And it's such a sort of seamless presentation. And then to play the full game and have it overwritten with sort of, you know, B-grade, English voice acting, it lost something for sure, and it was something that I was really, really excited to have back for the sequel.
Definitely.
Yeah, it seems like one of those things, like watching a good foreign movie. I mean, you wouldn't dream of dubbing a really good, you know, foreign film. It seems like it's just a step in the right direction, and if it's cheaper as well, it seems the way to go.
Yeah.
My understanding was that at the time Yakuza 1 was released, there was like Sony had certification requirements that there has to be an English voice track, and they basically didn't have room on the disc for both of them. But since Yakuza 2 came out so late in the PS2's lifespan, they eased up the requirements, which is great.
I had another thing. It seems that this style of gameplay you described, the core experience of Yakuza, which is not about this central spine of the narrative, but just being, the way the game conveys the sense of actually being in a city, of having those small details and those odd duck kind of moments that really kind of convey this feeling of particularity. This is a style of game that all the way across 2008, and I wrote about this a little, and especially in distinction to 2007, where you had a lot of very linear, closed worlds in terms of the best games like Call of Duty 4 and BioShock, very linear, very evocative, but very linear kind of games. Where it seems to me in 2008, we've seen this design philosophy of really aiming to create a world that you can wander about and just find interesting things to do in, and have the core experience just be about that experience. Has really, this year we've seen, I think, new things occur along those ways. When I think of all the games that were really compelling to me, GTA is one of them, but also Far Cry 2 and Fallout, the way they just allow you to really get this strong sense that you're inhabiting a setting that is interesting, and interesting in a way that the real world is interesting. I thought that was a real achievement. It's something we've never seen before to this degree. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was what I thought when I was playing Yakuza 2, was that I wished the entire game was the freeform structure stuff, and I could kind of mine all of that that big net of content in an undirected way. And that was one of the reasons that I loved Fallout 3 so much. I then played Fallout 3 and I was like, wow, the whole world is open to me. And what I do is I walk in a direction and see if there's anything interesting, and I dig deep and a little story comes out of this spot that I decided to invest in. And then I can go back out into the world and see what else is there.
I did that for hours and hours with Fallout 3,
Yeah, even when you intended to go somewhere very specific, you're like, I'm going to go Washington Monument. 14 hours later, you're like, you've done like 5 side quests. And oh, yeah, the Washington Monument. That's right.
Well, as the storytelling guy, the defender of the storytelling mode, often I find myself in that mode. It seems to me that what Yakuza 2 does well is construct a story that has all this other gameplay around it. But it is possible, if you're open to it, to be drawn into the story, and in particular, I think the characters. I found them interesting, and I found the story interesting, and I was okay with the fact that it was melodramatic. I mean, The Godfather is melodramatic. It was a world that made sense to me, with characters that seemed motivated by stuff that seemed believable. And you got these little moments, little scenes between characters that would, they've just met and they're sort of kind of feeling each other out. Stuff that you don't see often in games, the small bits of conversation that aren't necessarily driving narrative forward, but are mostly just characters, talking like you would talk to somebody in the first moments of getting to know them. I don't know. I found myself, interested in that, and it made the game a lot of fun for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing I think that is the toughest for me is when those moments are completely segregated from the rest of the game, which is how most of Yakuza 2 was. Like, there was only one or two sequences where you actually existed in the game world, where you could run around and fight guys and stuff, like with the female lead, and the rest of the time she only existed in cutscenes. Like the kinds of interactions that you talk about, like people chatting and getting to know each other and kind of just idly mentioning what's on their mind and expressing their opinions, really can happen out in the game world. Like, you could be walking around the streets of Tokyo in a very systemic way, and the female character could be following you, and you kind of, there's voice dialogue that's being fired off, like when you're driving in the car with an NPC in GTA 4, for instance. And it's that kind of integration that I think can really help both elements live together and probably be more effective from both sides.
Yeah. I wonder, when you enter into those side missions that are sort of separate from the narrative, is it possible that those side missions, I mean, is sort of the charm of those that they are so disconnected, that they are so sort of wacky, or would it be possible to somehow connect some of those side missions more directly into narrative stuff? Or would you even want that?
Well, I mean, I think that part of what's so effective about them is that they are so low investment. Like on the broader story and the development side, they just have so little overhead. You know, like it doesn't. You know, if I remember, one of the guys I met was just a dude who had amnesia, and he was like a little joke character you met for kind of 5 minutes, and it's like that guy could be there because he didn't have to be part of Kazuma Kiryu's like main, you know, epic life of betrayal and everything. He could just kind of be a dude standing off in an alley,
right?
And he didn't have to have a $10,000 cinematic associated with him. He could just be a normal NPC with some special text and a little bit of scripting that someone probably did in a few days. And I think that freedom to just do something that doesn't have to matter, quote unquote, or be important or whatever, just allows you to have a much broader and sort of lighter spread of experiences within that world.
Right. Which I guess, strictly speaking, if you're thinking about how the world works and how we sort of deal with it, most things that we confront have little to do with our own stories. I mean, the idea that you move around a game world and meet characters and do things that aren't interested in you or don't necessarily have anything to do with your big story is actually, if you get right down to it, more realistic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you guys have stayed longer than I promised that I would make you stay. I said 30 minutes and we've gone a bit longer than that, but it sure has been a terrific conversation and well worth having, I think. And I was telling these guys before we started that I was feeling kind of tired. It's been a very long week and we're recording this kind of late in the evening on Friday. But, you know, you guys whipped me right into shape. This was a really interesting conversation, and I love what you guys do. I love the work you guys do. I hope you guys know that. And
likewise.
And I have to say, Tom,
so much to me, Michael.
One thing I'm disappointed about, though, is we didn't get any hot scoops.
Oh God, no hot scoops at all.
You have to hit up Lee for that.
I am going. I am. We did a marathon recording session for Idle Thumbs last night. They'll be going up for the next couple of weeks, so that'll satisfy your appetite for hot scoops.
That's what I like. That's what
if
I
you like. Have one, actually, if you have one, I'm sorry for you, but you can come to us for that.
I'm not so much into the hot scoops. I'm more into the more measured response to news, or not even news, just like general trends in game development. From the start, when I started doing my recordings, that was really more of my thrust. I didn't want to do just news. I wanted to kind of get into the mindset of how developers think and how they do what they do. So, that really was more, what I was after. More of a fly on the wall perspective. So, hot scoops isn't really my thing.
I understand. Well, one thing, Tom, I'm hoping for is that we'll hear more of your podcast work. Is there anything that you're thinking about on that front?
I had a couple things lined up, but it's been all I can do just to stay afloat right now. So the podcast might go on hiatus for a little while. I it already has been for a while, and I apologize. I'd imagine that our listening audiences have some overlap. So to anyone who's listening to this who also listens to my show, I apologize for not being more timely in my releases. I know I've tried to stay pretty good. For the first 2.5 years the show was out, I was pretty good. But this year in particular has been very hard for me. So
yeah.
Your patience is much appreciated.
Well, I appreciate you taking time. I know that it has been a tough year, but when you talk to developers, I listened to your stuff before I started my podcast because I wasn't confident about how I might talk to such people. So I really hope that you keep doing that. And I really hope that we hear more podcasts from you soon, because I would argue nobody does that as well as you.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you also to you, Wes, and Steve. Will we be seeing each other at GDC? Are you going to go to GDC, Wes, any chance?
I'm going to try to go. How do you go there?
Maybe you have to get invited. And,
well, it's in San Francisco.
The contact person for GDC 09, I actually put in my request, and she's like, well, we filled all our invitations. Like, wait, I work for Gamasutra.
That should get you in, I would think.
Well, I'm still thinking I might not make it this year because of budgetary reasons, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
So you're going to go, Mike?
Yeah, I registered a couple days ago.
Outstanding. Well, I will see you there then.
Definitely. Definitely.
I'm going to try to go. Maybe I'll make a Steve Gaynor costume.
And, ooh.
Sneak in.
I like it. That
barely consists of a forged pass, I think, because they don't know what anybody looks like. But to anyone who actually thinks they can forge a pass, they started putting radio transceiver things in them. So it's pretty tough now.
Wow.
Don't go to Kinko's for no good reason.
Mm. Word to the wise.
Yeah.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thanks very much for your time and have a great weekend. Happy holidays to you. And real quickly, a quick roundup. We chose Yakuza 2 and Fallout 3 and Castle Crashers and GTA 4. Those are our recommended favorite games of 2008. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Mike.
Oh, thanks very much.
Okay, take care.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays
Bye.
To you. Bye-bye. Well, I'm going to wrap up this three-volume set with a very brief segment where I talk a little bit about my favorite. And I'm going to, right up front, I'm going to tell you I'm copping out a little bit because it's my show, so I can change the rules. I think the best game of 2008 was Fallout 3. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I've written a lot about that game, and a lot of people have. It's not my favorite game of 2008. And in fact, as an RPG, I like Fable 2 better. It appealed to me more, and I like it. I like it better aesthetically and, you know, for all sorts of reasons. But if I had to be completely honest about what I think is the finest achievement in game design this year, to me personally, I think it's Fallout 3. I think it's just, it's a devastating game in some ways. And it delivers a kind of experience that I've never had before with a game. So I admire the game. I may not like it as much as, say, Fable 2 or some other games, but I admire it tremendously. However, Fable 2, Fallout 3, neither are my favorite game. My favorite games this year, if I think hard about it, and the games that delivered the most fun for me, were Little Big Planet and No More Heroes. Those two games, and it would be hard to imagine two games more different than those two. And maybe that's why I put them together. I think they appeal to just completely different sides of my personality and different sides of my brain. But they also appeal, I think, in similar ways to the kind of pure gamer in me, the one that really admires, you know, games that kind of make that deep connection to you on a personal level as a game that just sort of, it means something to you. And you may not even want to recommend one or either of these games to certain friends of yours because then you know they might not like it. But for you personally, it's the kind of a game that appeals, if you know what I mean. Those two games do it for me. However, I'm going to say that my favorite game, 2008, here's the cop-out, is co-op gaming. I think this was the year that co-op gaming came of age. I think co-op gaming this year is better than it's ever been. I think it's more mature than it's ever been. I think it appeals to the sort of whole gamer in a kind of way, like it hasn't before. And the assortment of games that you can choose from with really terrific, exciting co-op play that doesn't seem dumbed down or doesn't seem to sort of add a second person on, sort of, so you can call it co-op, but the second person kind of gets a lesser experience. These games that appealed to me this year, and I'm talking about Little Big Planet, I'm talking about Left 4 Dead, I'm talking about World of Goo, I'm talking about Rock Band, Rock Band 2. Those games just delivered a lot of fun for me this year. And I think the bigger picture really for me there with those four games is they're all terrific games in and of themselves, but what they really say to me is that co-op gaming really delivered this year. I found it more compelling than ever. I'm excited about 2009 to see, you know, sort of what else we can do with co-op gaming. But to me, 2008 was about playing games with other people and having a lot of fun with them. And so co-op gaming is my game of 2008. Thanks to all of you for listening. And I once again want to express my appreciation to my guests, all of them who generously agreed to spend time with me and talk about their favorite games. I hope this has been interesting to you and fun. And I want to wish all of you happy, happy holidays. I'll see you back here in 2009. And in the meantime, happy gaming.